The English New Testament and the Court of Rome. Chapter 2. The Two Authorities. Wolsey did not stop with Fish's book. It was not that miserable pamphlet, only that it was necessary to hunt down. The New Testament in English had entered the kingdom by surprise. There was the danger. The gospelers, who presumed to emancipate man from the priests and put him in absolute dependence on God, did precisely the reverse of what Rome demands. The cardinal hastened to assemble the bishops, and these, particularly Warham and Tunstall, who had long enjoyed the jests launched against superstition, took the matter seriously when they were shown that the New Testament was circulating throughout England. These priests believed with Wolsey that the authority of the Pope and of the clergy was a dogma to which all others were subordinate. They saw in the reform an uprising of the human mind, a desire of thinking for themselves, of judging freely the doctrines and institutions which the nations had hitherto received humbly from the hands of the priests. The new doctors justified their attempt at enfranchisement by substituting a new authority for the old. It was the New Testament that compromised the absolute power of Rome. It must be seized and destroyed, said the bishops. London, Oxford, and above all Cambridge, those three haunts of heresy, must be carefully searched. Definitive orders were issued on Saturday, February 3, 1526, and the work began immediately. The first visit of the inquisitors was to Honey Lane, to the house of the curate of All Hallows. They did not find Garrett. They sought after him at Monmouth's and throughout the city, but he could not be met with. "He has gone to Oxford to sell his detestable wares," the inquisitors were informed, and they set off after him immediately, determined to burn the evangelist and his books. "So burning hot," says an historian, "was the charity of these holy fathers." On Tuesday, the 6th of February, Garrett was quietly selling his books at Oxford and carefully noting down his sales in his register, when two of his friends ran to him exclaiming, "Fly, or else you will be taken before the cardinal, and thence to the Tower." The poor curate was greatly agitated. "From whom did you learn that?" "From Master Cole, the clerk of the assembly, who is deep in the cardinal's favor." Garrett, who saw at once that the affair was serious, hastened to Anthony Dalliber, who held the stock of the Holy Scriptures at Oxford. Others followed him. The news had spread rapidly, and those who had bought the book were seized with alarm, for they knew by the history of the Lollards what the Romish clergy could do. They took counsel together, the brethren, "for so did we not only call one another, but were indeed one to another," says Dalliber, "decided that Garrett should change his name, that Dalliber should give him a letter for his brother, the rector of Stallbridge, in Dorsetshire, who was in want of a curate, and that once in this parish, he should seek the first opportunity of crossing the sea." The rector was in truth a mad papist. It is Dalliber's expression, but that did not alter their resolution. They knew of no other resource. Anthony wrote to him hurriedly, and on the morning of the 7th of February, Garrett left Oxford without being observed. Having provided for Garrett's safety, Dalliber next thought of his own. He carefully concealed in a secret recess of his chamber, at St. Albans Hall, Tyndale's Testament, and the works of Luther, Ecolampadius, and others, on the Word of God. Then, disgusted with the scholastic sophisms which he heard in that college, he took with him the New Testament and the commentary on the Gospel of St. Luke, by Lambert of Avignon, the second edition of which had just been published at Strasbourg, and went to Gloucester College, where he intended to study the civil law, not caring to have anything more to do with the church. During this time, poor Garrett was making his way into Dorsetshire. His conscience could not bear the idea of being, although for a short time only, the curate of a bigoted priest, of concealing his faith, his desires, and even his name. He felt more wretched, although at liberty, than he could have been in Wolsey's prisons. "It is better," he said within himself, "to confess Christ before the judgment seat, than to seem to approve of the superstitious practices I detest." He went forward a little, then stopped, and then resumed his course. There was a fierce struggle between his fears and his conscience. At length, after a day and a half spent in doubt, his conscience prevailed. Unable to endure any longer the anguish that he felt, he retraced his steps, returned to Oxford, which he entered on Friday evening, and lay down calmly in his bed. It was barely past midnight when Wolsey's agents, who had received information of his return, arrived, and dragged him from his bed, and delivered him up to Dr. Cottesford, the commissary of the university. The latter locked him up in one of his rooms, while London and Higden, Dean of Frideswyde, two archpapists, as the chronicler terms them, announced this important capture to the cardinal. They thought Popery was saved, because a poor curate had been taken. Dalibor, engaged in preparing his new room at Gloucester College, had not perceived all this commotion. On Saturday, at noon, having finished his arrangements, he double-locked his door, and began to read the Gospel according to St. Luke. All of a sudden he hears a knock. Dalibor made no reply. It is no doubt the commissary's officers. A louder knock was given, but he still remained silent. Immediately after, there was a third knock, as if the door would be beaten in. "Perhaps somebody wants me," thought Dalibor. He laid his book aside, opened the door, and to his great surprise saw Garrett, who, with alarm in every feature, exclaimed, "I am a lost man! They have caught me!" Dalibor, who thought his friend was with his brother at Stallbridge, could not conceal his astonishment, and at the same time he cast an uneasy glance on a stranger who accompanied Garrett. He was one of the college servants who had led the fugitive curate to Dalibor's new room. As soon as this man had gone away, Garrett told Anthony everything. "Observing that Dr. Cottesford and his household had gone to prayers, I put back the bolt of the lock with my finger, and here I am." "Alas, Master Garrett," replied Dalibor, "the imprudence you committed in speaking to me before that young man has ruined us both." At these words, Garrett, who had resumed his fear of the priests, now that his conscience was satisfied, exclaimed with a voice interrupted by sighs and tears, "For mercy's sake, help me! Save me!" Without waiting for an answer, he threw off his frock and hood, begged Anthony to give him a sleeved coat, and thus disguised, he said, "I will escape into Wales, and from there, if possible, to Germany and Luther." Garrett checked himself. There was something to be done before he left. The two friends fell on their knees and prayed together. They called upon God to lead his servant to a secure retreat. That done, they embraced each other, their faces bathed with tears, and unable to utter a word. Silent on the threshold of his door, Dalibor followed both with eyes and ears his friend's retreating footsteps. Having heard him reach the bottom of the stairs, he returned to his room, locked the door, took out his New Testament, and placing it before him, read on his knees the 10th chapter of the Gospel of St. Matthew, breathing many a heavy sigh. "Ye shall be brought before governors and kings for my sake, but fear them not. The very hairs of your head are all numbered." This reading having revived his courage, Anthony, still on his knees, prayed fervently for the fugitive and for all his brethren. "O God, by thy Holy Spirit endue with heavenly strength this tender and newborn little flock in Oxford. Christ's heavy cross is about to be laid on the weak shoulders of thy poor sheep. Grant that they may bear it with godly patience and unflinching zeal." Rising from his knees, Dalibor put away his book, folded up Garrett's hood and frock, placed them among his own clothes, locked his room door, and proceeded to the Cardinal's College, now Christ Church, to tell Clark and the other brethren what had happened. They were in chapel. The evening service had begun. The dean and canons, in full costume, were chanting in the choir. Dalibor stopped at the door listening to the majestic sounds of the organ at which Taverner presided, and to the harmonious strains of the choristers. They were singing the Magnificat, "My soul doth magnify the Lord. He hath hope in his servant Israel." It seemed to Dalibor that they were singing Garrett's deliverance, but his voice could not join in their song of praise. "Alas," he exclaimed, "all my singing and music is turned into sighing and musing." As he listened, leaning against the entrance into the choir, Dr. Cottesford, the university commissary, arrived with hasty step, bareheaded and as pale as ashes. He passed Anthony without noticing him, and going straight to the dean appeared to announce some important and unpleasant news. "I know well the cause of his sorrow," thought Dalibor as he watched every gesture. The commissary had scarcely finished his report when the dean arose, and both left the choir with undisguised confusion. They had only reached the middle of the ante-chapel when Dr. London ran in, puffing and chafing and stamping, like a hungry and greedy lion seeking his prey. All three stopped, questioned each other, and deplored their misfortune. Their rapid and eager movements indicated the liveliest emotion. London above all could not restrain himself. He attacked the commissary, and blamed him for his negligence, so that at last Cottesford burst into tears. "Deeds, not tears," said the fanatical London, and forthwith they dispatched officers and spies along every road. Anthony, having left the chapel, hurried to Clark's to tell him of the escape of his friend. "We are walking in the midst of wolves and tigers," replied Clark. "Prepare for persecution. Prudentia serpentina et simplicitas columbina. The wisdom of serpents and the harmlessness of doves must be our motto. O God, give us the courage these evil times require." All in the little flock were delighted at Garrett's deliverance. Sumner and Betts, who had come in, ran off to tell it to the other brethren in the college, and Dalibor hastened to Corpus Christi. All these pious young men felt themselves to be soldiers in the same army, travelers in the same company, brothers in the same family. Fraternal love nowhere shone so brightly in the days of the Reformation as among the Christians of Great Britain. This is a feature worthy of notice. Fitz James, Udall, and Dyett were met together in the rooms of the latter, at Corpus Christi College, when Dalibor arrived. They ate their frugal meal, with downcast eyes and broken voices, conversing of Oxford, of England, and of the perils hanging over them. Then rising from table they fell on their knees, called upon God for aid, and separated, Fitz James taking Dalibor with him to St. Albans Hall. They were afraid that the servant of Gloucester College had betrayed him. The disciples of the gospel at Oxford passed the night in great anxiety. Garrett's flight, the rage of the priests, the dangers of the rising church, the roaring of a storm that filled the air and re-echoed through the long cloisters all impressed them with terror. On Sunday, the 11th of February, Dalibor, who was stirring at 5 in the morning, set out for his room in Gloucester College. Finding the gates shut, he walked up and down beneath the walls in the mud, for it had rained all night. As he paced to and fro along the solitary street in the obscure dawn, a thousand thoughts alarmed his mind. It was known, he said to himself, that he had taken part in Garrett's flight. He would be arrested, and his friend's escape would be revenged on him. He was weighed down by sorrow and alarm. He sighed heavily. He imagined he saw Wolsey's commissioners demanding the names of his accomplices, and pretending to draw up a proscription list at his dictation. He recollected that on more than one occasion cruel priests had extorted from the Lollards the names of the brethren, and terrified at the possibility of such a crime, he exclaimed, "O God, I swear to thee that I will accuse no man. I will tell nothing but what is perfectly well known." At last, after an hour of anguish, he was able to enter the college. He hastened in, but when he tried to open his door, he found that the lock had been picked. The door gave way to a strong push, and what a sight met his eyes. His bedstead overturned, the blankets scattered on the floor, his clothes all confusion in his wardrobe, his study broken into and left open. He doubted not that Garrett's dress had betrayed him, and he was gazing at this sad spectacle in alarm, when a monk who occupied the adjoining rooms came and told him what had taken place. "The commissary and two proctors, armed with swords and bills, broke open your door in the middle of the night. They pierced your bedstraw through and through to make sure Garrett was not hidden there. They carefully searched every nook and corner, but were not able to discover any traces of the fugitive." At these words Dalibor breathed again, but the monk had not ended. "I have orders," he added, "to send you to the prior." Anthony Dunstan, the prior, was a fanatical and avaricious monk, and the confusion into which this message threw Dalibor was so great that he went just as he was, all bespattered with mud, to the rooms of his superior. The prior, who was standing with his face towards the door, looked at Dalibor from head to foot as he came in. "Where did you pass the night?" he asked. "At St. Albans Hall with Fitz James." The prior, with a gesture of incredulity, continued, "Was not Master Garrett with you yesterday?"
"Yes."
"Where is he now?"
"I do not know."
During this examination, the prior had remarked a large double gilt silver ring on Anthony's finger, with the initials AD.
"Show me that," said the prior.
Dalibor gave him the ring, and the prior, believing it to be of solid gold, put it on his own finger, adding with a cunning leer, "This ring is mine, it bears my name. A is for Anthony, and D for Dunstan." "Would to God," thought Dalibor, "that I were as well delivered from his company, as I am sure of being delivered of my ring." At this moment the chief beadle, with two or three of the commissary's men, entered and conducted Dalibor to the chapel of Lincoln College, where three ill-omened figures were standing beside the altar. They were Cottesford, London, and Higden. "Where is Garrett?" asked London, and pointing to his disordered dress he continued,
Your shoes and garments covered with mud prove that you have been out all night with him. If you do not say where you have taken him, you will be sent to the tower.
Yes, added Higden,
to Little's, one of the most horrible dungeons in the prison, and you will be put to the torture, do you hear?
Then the three doctors spent 2 hours attempting to shake the young man by flattering promises and frightful threats. But all was useless. The commissary then gave a sign, the officers stepped forward, and the judges ascended a narrow staircase leading to a large room situated above the commissary's chamber. Here Dalibor was deprived of his purse and girdle, and his legs were placed in the stocks, so that his feet were almost as high as his head. When that was done, the three doctors devoutly went to mass. Poor Anthony, left alone in this frightful position, recollected the warning Clark had given him 2 years before. He groaned heavily and cried to God,
O Father, that my suffering may be for thy glory, and for the consolation of my brethren. Happen what may, I will never accuse one of them.
After this noble protest, Anthony felt an increase of peace in his heart, but a new sorrow was reserved for him. Garrett, who had directed his course westwards, with the intention of going to Wales, had been caught at Hinksey, a short distance from Oxford. He was brought back, and thrown into the dungeon in which Dalibor had been placed after the torture. Their gloomy presentiments were to be more than fulfilled. In fact, Wolsey was deeply irritated at seeing the college, Christ Church, which he had intended should be the most glorious in the world, made the haunt of heresy, and the young men, whom he had so carefully chosen, become distributors of the New Testament. By favoring literature, he had had in view the triumph of the clergy, and literature had on the contrary served to the triumph of the gospel. He issued his orders without delay, and the university was filled with terror. John Clark, John F. R. White D.H., Henry Sumner, William Betts, Richard Taverner, Richard Cox, Michael Drum, Godfrey Harmon, Thomas Lawney, Radley, and others besides of Cardinals College, Udall, Diet, and others of Corpus Christi, Eden and several of his friends of Magdalene, Goodman, William Bailey, Robert Farrer, John Salisbury of Gloucester, Barnard, and St. Mary's Colleges, were seized and thrown into prison. Wolsey had promised them glory. He gave them a dungeon, hoping in this manner to save the power of the priests, and to repress that awakening of truth and liberty which was spreading from the continent to England. Under Cardinals College there was a deep cellar sunk in the earth, in which the butler kept his salt fish. Into this hole these young men, the choice of England, were thrust. The dampness of this cave, the corrupted air they breathed, the horrible smell given out by the fish, seriously affected the prisoners, already weakened by study. Their hearts were bursting with groans, their faith was shaken, and the most mournful scenes followed each other in this foul dungeon. The wretched captives gazed on one another, wept, and prayed. This trial was destined to be a salutary one to them.
Alas, said F.R.Y.T.H. on a subsequent occasion, I see that besides the word of God, there is indeed a second purgatory, but it is not that invented by Rome. It is the cross of tribulation to which God has nailed us.
At last the prisoners were taken out one by one and brought before their judges. Two only were released. The first was Betts, afterwards chaplain to and Bullen. They had not been able to find any prohibited books in his room, and he pleaded his cause with great talent. The other was Taverner. He had hidden Clark's books under his schoolroom floor, where they had been discovered, but his love for the arts saved him.
Shaw, he is only a musician, said the cardinal.
All the rest were condemned. A great fire was kindled at the top of the marketplace. A long procession was marshaled, and these unfortunate men were led out, each bearing a faggot. When they came near the fire, they were compelled to throw into it the heretical books that had been found in their rooms, after which they were taken back to their noisome prison. There seemed to be a barbarous pleasure in treating these young and generous men so vilely. In other countries also, Rome was preparing to stifle in the flames the noblest geniuses of France, Spain, and Italy. Such was the reception letters and the gospel met with from popery in the 16th century. Every plant of God's must be beaten by the wind, even at the risk of its being uprooted. If it receives only the gentle rays of the sun, there is reason to fear that it will dry up and wither before it produces fruit. Except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. There was to arise one day a real church in England, for the persecution had begun. We have to contemplate still further trials.